are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
You have to be a kind leader, you have to be humble, and you have to build those relationships. Without those relationships, I think a school is nothing.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Paul Ainsworth, former head teacher and current school improvement director at Infinity Academies Trust in Boston, Lincolnshire. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are a day's work experience in a school lighting Paul's teaching fire, how school leaders can support their staff during the pandemic, and kindness and relationships being the key to a thriving school community.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I'm interviewing Paul Ainsworth. Paul, good morning.
Hi Ross, lovely to speak to you.
Yeah, so for listeners, Paul and I have been connected for 11 years through social media, and this is the first time we're actually getting to talk properly, so that maybe there are some benefits of lockdown. Paul, tell everyone a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and where you're tuning in from.
Okay, Ross. So I had a very traditional school leadership background, working my way up in a secondary school through head of department, senior leader, head teacher. And about 6 years ago, I joined one of the big multi-academy trusts and have had a really fascinating journey supporting primary schools and secondary schools. And now I work for Infinity Academies Trust in Boston, Lincolnshire, which is just such a lovely multi-academy trust. Great people, fab CEO, great head teachers, lovely teachers. And so that's where I am today. I'm in Boston St. Nicholas, a C of E primary academy. I'm sat in our little office looking out on the playground, which I can't wait to see filled with children next week.
So that sounds very exciting. And I know your career has not always been rosy. I guess you and I kind of maybe first connected through our secondary leadership experiences, you know, disadvantaged schools, those tough kind of journeys that we all go through. Maybe if we rewind, in fact, I want to rewind even further. Let's go back to your 16-year-old self. Could you describe to listeners what kind of young lad you were at school?
I was very competitive. I was in a not great comprehensive school. Children didn't really go on to university and that kind of thing. In a rural area, so people stayed in the town and got jobs. But I was very competitive. I used to love my cricket. Used to play rugby for the school and kind of racket sports and those kind of things. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to go to university. Really conscious of that idea of if you go to university, it's going to be really expensive and you need to do something that's got a job at the end. So I chose to do chemical engineering.
Wow.
And didn't really enjoy it. So, you know, at kind of 16, I had, you know, if you'd have asked me what would I become, I don't know. I certainly never envisaged I would become a teacher.
So when did the teacher conversation start?
So teacher conversation started when I completed my degree, and both my mother and father-in-law had been, you know, career teachers, and there weren't many jobs around in the mid-90s, and I was looking for a job, and my father-in-law said, why don't you become a teacher? You'd be great. You know, you love talking to people. I can really see you doing that. And I can remember doing a day's work experience with my mother-in-law in quite a tough school in Scunthorpe. She was worked with EAL children, kind of a big Somalian community at that time. And I went into this really tough little primary school and spent the day with a year six teacher. And I loved it. It was great. And that was the kind of eye opener of why not? Why not become a teacher?
Great.
And I took, you know, I feel I can remember my mother and father-in-law, I think it was Boxing Day, almost standing over me while I filled in my PGCE.
Right, fantastic. So was it chemistry? Was it science that you got into?
No, actually it was maths. because I can remember thinking, what would I prefer to teach, and being a little bit scared about the idea of children doing practicals. And I'd had some fantastic maths teachers who weren't textbook people. It was all about investigations and setting problems and puzzles.
Yeah.
And I'd really enjoyed that. And I thought, well, actually, I think there's a lot I can do with this.
So where was your first job?
First job was in a secondary modern in Lincolnshire at a small town called Holbeach. And to just give a little bit of context, the year I started, I think 14% of children in year 11 had got 5 GCSEs.
Goodness.
So not 5 GCSEs including English and maths, but just 5 GCSEs. It was a nice school, but you know, children, you know, the top had been creamed off to go to the local grammar school, and a lot of children who felt they were failures, and that was, you know, what it was like. And I suppose what I did was, you know, in that kind of idea of youth that you can do anything. Well, no, anybody can pass a GCSE. Of course they can. All we've got to do is try and teach them.
Sure.
So that was my starting point on my journey.
And when did the leadership conversation start?
So the leadership conversation started really early on, actually. I kind of got the idea I wanted to be a leader. And I can remember talking to a head teacher, and she asked me at interview, where would you like to be? And I kind of smiled at her and said, oh, well, I suppose the smart answer would be, I'd really like to have your job in 15 years. Time.
Brilliant.
And she shuffled in her chair. But I would never dare say that. So I don't, and I can remember saying, I don't actually know why I've just given that response to you. And she sat there and said, okay, let's get a piece of pen and paper out. If you'd like to be a head teacher in 15 years time, what's your journey going to look like?
Great.
And she plotted it. And that was the start.
And I guess did that mirror, did that, can you remember that actual conversation and, you know, what that plot or journey looked like, and did it match reality?
I can't really remember much more than, okay, so be, you know, really hone your classroom teaching over a few more years, then look at seeing if you can become a second in maths or a head of maths, you know, then look at a deputy headship and then look at a headship. And I can't remember much more than that, but it was more her, the way that she responded to me and the way she smiled and grinned and kind of plotted this career. I'd never met anybody like that before. So that was kind of, you know, a lovely experience.
So, I know you've been a head teacher. So talk us through your headship career and let everyone know, you know, some of your highs and low points, I suppose.
Okay, so worked in a kind of really, really interesting secondary school. It wasn't a deprived area at all. It was a really nice rural area at that time. And it was a middle school, and we took the journey of taking that school to become an 11 to 16 school, got some really good results, you know, really amazing results, you know, second and third in the county at one stage. And then as happened to kind of lots of people, you know, when schools merged and federated and became bigger organisations, you know, the results stayed high, but we had one of those adverse Ofsted experiences that kind of lots of people have had. I know you kind of had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you reevaluate your leadership.
It does.
It makes you reevaluate, you know, what you want to do and how you're going to do things. And that was a really big learning experience.
And I know you had, particularly on that Ofsted point, you went through particular difficulties yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, I did find it really difficult, kind of affected me quite considerably at the time. And I really struggled. I had no confidence at all. And I think listeners might find this hard to believe, but one of the real turning points was something that you did. And I don't think you necessarily know how important it was to me. There was a day in November of 2014. It was a dark evening and I was walking my Labrador across the fields,
mm-hmm.
and I was really thinking, I just don't know what the next step is.
Sure.
And I was looking at my mobile phone, and you know, you're kind of walking around looking at my mobile phone, and you'd written an article, and I know these articles aren't popular and they've come in for a lot of criticism, but you'd written an article, it was a top 100.
Yeah.
A top 100 educationists or top 100 teachers.
I think it was I think it was just people that I follow on Twitter, I suppose. I think from memory.
Something like that. And my confidence was at rock bottom. It was really low. I didn't know what to do next. And I'd flicked through the list and I was on the list. And it was like, Ross McGill's put me on the list. And you wrote something really nice about my writing. And I felt a foot taller.
Great.
Carried on my walk. And that gave me the confidence. That gave me the confidence to go and work for this big multi-academy trust.
Well, I'm very flattered, Paul. It just shows you the power of social media, doesn't it? I was going to ask what gave you what kind of sparked your mojo to get back into teaching. So I'm very flattered there. If anything, that list was, you know, who do I regularly follow on Twitter? You know, with a growing community of teachers joining, you know, it's a huge network now. But I guess rewinding 7 or 8 years, it was still quite a small community. It was a bit weird for you to be on Twitter, I suppose. So, yeah, the 100 was people I would regularly dip in and out of because, you know, it's a struggle for all of us to have 5 or 10 close friends nearby, never mind trying to know 500 people on our Twitter networks. So I'm delighted to hear that, Paul. So 7 years on, you're now in a lovely little primary school, very happy. Tell us more about your work in your current role.
So, you know, taking this, you know, a lot of it is taking those experiences on board. And I think we both know how hard it is to be a school leader and how hard and lonely it is to be a head teacher. So my role is, you know, I'm classed as a school improvement director. That's the job title.
Yeah.
But for me, what the job is about is working with those head teachers. It's about giving them support. It's about providing a safe area for them to talk about what they're worried about, what their anxieties are, to have those open conversations about how we can improve schools and use those experiences I've got of working with, you know, in my multi-academy trust work, I worked with some really challenging schools. You know, I worked with schools that had gone into special measures, mm-hmm. schools where, you know, one school that had the kind of lowest results in Hull and didn't deserve that. And I learned a lot of working with those schools. And a lot of that experience was in helping head teachers plan what to do next, and then helping them keep going, because it's so hard. It's so hard.
It is very hard. Before we came on live, I said to Paul, everyone, that I remember reading one of his articles ourselves around our leadership table about 2011 to 14 in a particular school that was very tough in Tottenham. So you've written lots, Paul. You've just published your own little book, haven't you?
I've published, it's called No Silver Bullets, Day In, Day Out School Improvement. I'm getting some really good responses from people that I know and people that I don't know. It's really exciting next step. It's the 9th book that I've written.
Wow.
The first one that I've self-published. So
great.
To kind of be completely responsible for everything has been quite a nerve-wracking experience.
Yeah, well, you got the whole, you know, having done the books myself, the whole, you know, start to end process of the book cover, the glue, the layout, the typography. The self-publishing is a tough road to go. Tell us, you know, some of the kind of small details of that process.
So, I mean, it's a lot more straightforward than it used to be with kind of, you know, our big online distributor that we won't name, that the way they enable you to self-publish is really straightforward. So if anybody does want to publish their own book, it's kind of a really straightforward process to do.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the big task is getting all those words down and how difficult that is, you know, squeezing the half an hour here and the hour there. And because as both of us with our families, we maybe don't get time to that luxury of sitting there and writing for 7 hours at a stretch. Getting the kind of words down is always the challenge. I love designing the front cover. I loved writing the blurb. It's been great getting comments from mm-hmm. Leaders that I've worked with in the past for the cover, you know, and sending extracts to them and saying what you think. What's been really difficult is the proofreading. That's a real challenge. And I've had some great help. So one of the head teachers in my own trust, Sarah Paul, took it on herself to help me proofread it. And she was so helpful with her primary experience. And Jill Berry, who I know you know, she also read it for me and did some proofreading for me. So bless them, you know, to spend that time, you know, just out of the goodness of their hearts to proofread it has been fantastic.
Jill, I always describe Jill as the Twitter fairy godmother of the teaching profession. She seems to offer a lot of feedback to a wide range of people and give up her time endlessly. So a shout out to Jill, who I've followed for a number of years also. She's fantastic. And we know that book process, you know, the deep focus is the hardest part alongside not only being a school leader and having a family. So how do you currently kind of manage your own work, Paul? Your mental health, your family, your leadership commitments. What are your pieces of advice to listeners?
My biggest piece of advice that I always say to everybody is don't have your work emails on your mobile phone.
Yeah.
And that sounds silly, but some of my worst moments have been when I've been sat there on a Friday evening, you know, you've got a glass of wine or whatever you like, and you're watching TV with your family and an email drops in.
And it's a nightmare.
You know, and it's a complaint.
Yeah.
Or it's a member of staff, you know, kind of complaining, or it's a parent complaining. And that just derails your whole weekend.
Yeah, it does.
So that is my biggest advice. Don't have your work emails on your mobile phone. Have a device that is clean, so as to speak. That isn't to say that, you know, I've got my WhatsApp, I've got my text messages. So if any of my head teachers really want to contact me, there's something that's happened, send me a text. You know, send me a WhatsApp. You know, I trust them. They'd only do it when they really needed that. But I don't need to see those iffy emails because that just ruins it.
Sure.
I think the other thing is, I mean, writing I found is a real outlet.
It is.
I started writing when I was a deputy head. And part of my writing was a little bit around, if I was running my own school, what would it look like? If I had complete freedom, what would that be? And that's certainly, you know, how my writing, you know, first started off in that way. So writing's a real outlet, whether it's writing books, whether it's doing your journal. There's some great self-help planners out there. Mm-hmm. So that's a big outlet. And you know, the reading as well. I mean, I know you love reading and being able to take yourself to another place, whether it's reading about, you know, how a teacher's transformed a school, or whether it's reading about your favourite sport or just a fantastic piece of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That has always been one of my big outlets, you know, way back to being those first instances of remembering reading Danny the Champion of the World or the Silver Sword.
It's very therapeutic. I remember on my dog walk this morning talking about Sophie's World, which renewed my teenage love of reading, I suppose. And those three simple questions that are posed in the book: who are you, where are you going, and where are you from? And so I guess to you, Paul, you know, we're recording this during the pandemic. How has that been for you in your leadership period, your kind of role supporting schools? We know the challenges, but just give listeners just an insight into how your school has responded to those challenges.
So I think that the head teachers that I work with are even more grateful for being part of a very trusting, family-focused mat. If we go way back to, you know, that first day of closure, what was it, March the 20th, almost 12 months ago, you know, we sat down, myself, Gavin, the CEO, and the five head teachers, what are we going to do? What's it going to look like? How can we help? What can we take off you? So Gavin and I, you know, took things like risk assessments. Gavin wrote to all the parents, so it wasn't just the head teachers, it was, you know, him communicating those parents. He did, you know, vlogs and blogs and spoke to parents directly just to really support, because the head teachers had that logistical issue of looking after their own staff and trying to get children in, whether it was, you know, that first lockdown or whether it was after the May-June half term, and anything that we could do to try and make their life a little bit easier. One thing that we've really noticed over the pandemic is how often we've spoken. So there's been times when we've had, daily, Zoom or Teams calls, and that's been great for building the team as well. You know, that everybody, the six of us there, and now seven of us. Mm-hmm. What's happening? Is there anything we can help you with? And I think they've found it really useful to just be able to talk things through and know that they're definitely not on their own. You know, myself and Gavin are really there to just look after them, because we need them to do their job. We need them to look after their teachers. We need them to make that safe environment for their children. And we'll do everything we can to help them with that.
Well, that's great to hear. You know, I'm reminded of, as you're talking, our connection through Twitter, I suppose, and how the teaching community shares ideas on Twitter. And you mentioned that your leaders are coming together on a daily Zoom call. Good ideas are evolved through connections and through conversations, and those good ideas tend to stick and surface to the top. So I guess on that note, Paul, if I could put you into a corner and say, what's the one thing you'd like to see change in education, given your wealth of experience, what would it be?
Now you got me. I didn't know you were going to ask me that.
Well, and
that
there you go. Kind of
really, there's so many things that I would. I think league tables. You know, I think we both rail against league tables, mm-hmm. and I think that would be fantastic. I don't think Ofsted in its current form helps schools. I really don't think it does. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a regulator that comes and visits us and checks that safeguarding is okay and those kind of things, and gives us suggestions of how we move forwards. But I think a grading system of four grades, where it, to me, does not help schools and doesn't help school leaders, and I don't think helps parents and children. So I think, league tables, Ofsted, they kind of need reformatting in a different way, definitely.
Sure. And, you'll know that workload's one of my passions, and we know it's a continual problem in schools. So I guess your own experiences and your visits or support in schools, across a wider region, what are the kind of the best things you've seen schools do in response to the pandemic specifically?
So the things that's, I think what's been really interesting in primary schools is, my work in them is, the majority of teachers have been in primary schools all the time. There's been less teaching from home. Mm-hmm. So I think there's, and what I've noticed is the way leaders has looked after those teachers. So they've been more flexible around the school day. So, and certainly at the end of the school day, in encouraging staff to leave sooner. And head teachers have led by example there, in terms of saying, look, no, we're all going to go at 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm. You've worked hard. We're all going to go. And I think that's helped everybody's well-being. Mm-hmm. I think what's been really interesting is around assessment and marking. Certainly in primary schools, teachers do a lot of marking, and I know it's the same in secondary schools as well, but an awful lot of marking in those three or four sets of books of 30 pupils being marked every evening, and that is a massive workload. And I think during the pandemic, people have started to look at how we can do that in a different way, in terms of whether we can do some conferencing. So we take five or six children to one side. I'm thinking of the September to Christmas stage. Mm-hmm. Can we take five or six children to one side, and rather than, writing, four sentences in their books, actually do something with those six children?
Yeah, that live feedback, Something I was posing to some schools, Paul, I don't know what you think about this, was adjusting your marketing and feedback policies for a remote teaching world, that online notification 24/7.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's been, in terms of, there is a danger with the remote learning, and that you could end up being constantly on call and constantly giving feedback to children and feeling under pressure to do that. So I think it's been really important for schools to kind of put structures in place and say to teachers, no, you are not on call all the time. These are your working hours. This is when you should respond. And trying to look at, as I said, how you can respond in a group way. I have seen some lovely Teams videos where a teacher has looked at a set of responses and then taught the whole class on Zoom just using those responses. I can think of a fantastic lesson at Wibberton Primary Academy that I saw from their year six teacher where he did that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been really interesting as well, that you don't have to put the feedback in the books. It's about the progress the children make. So how do you communicate that to children so they do make progress? It's not always sitting there writing, writing, writing.
No, it's not.
So that has been fascinating to watch.
So is there any kind of great little nuggets that your own school and trust have been doing that you could share with the wider community?
So probably one of the things that we did over, it was the second week of this lockdown in January, I asked all the head teachers and all the staff if they got any little tips that they could give, you know, other colleagues across the seven schools. You know, talk to your teaching assistant or talk in your teaching pair. Have you got a little idea that's made a difference? And I asked them to all email them to me, and that was brilliant. We got some great responses, and I put them together in a little booklet, and then we shared that out to all the staff. And that was a golden moment in so many ways. First of all, for staff to see their ideas in that booklet. Mm-hmm. They loved that, and maybe the staff in the school that maybe doesn't have the best reputation, they were, no, you are still a good teacher. You know, there's lots of good in this school, and mm-hmm. your ideas are just as important as anybody else's. So that was fantastic. A couple of new schools joining the trust, so they were delighted to see their ideas in Great. There as well, that you're part of the family. And that was and also to kind of build that network across the trust. You know, we've all got each other's email addresses. People can see those names. Oh, that's a really good idea about EYFS. Send them an email, have a conversation, you know, take it on to Teams. And that worked really well. And I think we've all done that in our own schools. I can remember in my secondary school back in the day, having a teaching and learning newsletter, you know, that we wrote, you know, every term. And, you know, good ideas are good ideas. And it's about how you refocus them in the new time. And yes, we produced a hard copy of that little booklet, but it could have just been as easily been done on a Sway or maybe something via Microsoft Forms or any of those things. But that was just a lovely moment in the darkness.
Right. So,
you know, this
Paul, I want to just ask, you know, kind of last big question. Your life as a teacher and as a school leader, you know, we know teaching and learning culture, etc., is a hard thing to crack. But could I ask for any insights? What makes a school community thrive?
I listened to our teacher yesterday, and she was doing a little presentation for me, and she said, you know, two words, and it was kindness and relationships.
Excellent.
And that is what I think you have to be. You have to be a kind leader. You have to be humble. And you have to build those relationships. Without those relationships, I think a school is nothing. Mm. And as a leader, without relationships with your staff, whether, you know, you're blessed to be a system leader like me, working with seven schools, whether you're a head teacher, to have those relationships with your staff, and that is more important than anything you can do. I think we've both seen leaders force things through without those relationships. It doesn't stick.
No.
It doesn't give sustainable improvement. It doesn't help people's
I'm
life,
actually thinking that, you know, on that note, you know, all the things that can improve the disadvantage gap in attainment, if our schools were given a bit more cash and a bit more time, you know, teachers need more time. If we had more time to talk to children and bridge those, you know, the mental health and, you know, the attainment gap, I suppose, through good conversations, I wonder if that would be the key to unlock, you know, academic outcomes, you know, world-class education. What do you think?
Well, it's confidence, isn't it? It's building people's confidence that they can do something. You know, we started this conversation, you know, asking me about my 16-year-old self, and it was having the confidence for me to go to university. Well, there's children that, you know, don't have confidence, they don't believe that they can achieve. And the best way of building confidence is building that relationship, talking to them in small groups, talking to them on their own. Yes, you can do it. I can always remember, you know, when I was a classroom teacher, above my whiteboard, it said, you can succeed today.
Yeah.
And a former pupil got in contact with me over LinkedIn, who I taught 15 years ago, said, I can still remember that sign over your board.
Great.
In Strainsworth. And this is what I've done with my life. And yeah, if we can build the confidence for our children that they can succeed in what they want to do, not what we think they should do, but what they want to do. So if you want to be a rock star, if you want to be, you know, a singer in an indie band, if you want to play, you know, football or, you know, go on the stage or whatever, you know, if you want to be an astrophysicist, you know, or be, yeah, an entrepreneur, we just have to give.
So I guess my question,
they can do that.
Is it too late for me to go to the moon?
Who knows?
I've always wanted to be an astronaut. Right, Paul, so for regular listeners, you'll know that we've gone way past our 20-minute barrier, and maybe you've been given an extra extra time, I suppose, because of our kind of long-established relationship. So what I do to finish is, because I kind of pose a few quizzy-type questions. You'll remember Timmy Mallett and that type of stuff. So no pause or hesitation on your side, please. So I'm going to just fire a few questions your way based on our conversation and a few things I've got written down here. So I'll start off with an easy one. What project are you working on? What's on your desk today?
So I'm going to spend the morning with Fiona Booth, head teacher of St Nicholas C of E Primary Academy Boston, looking at their curriculum for next term and next year.
Okay, what book are you reading?
Just finished a book called Shuggy Bane,
right,
which is a really challenging fiction read. Young boy, alcoholic mother, tough part of Glasgow, charting from about 85 to 95. Finished it last night. It was a tough read, but really fascinating.
Right, good. If we had 24 hours together in Boston, where would we go?
I think we'd take a drive out into the marshes and have a nice walk, chat, maybe sit down, have a few cans of beer. Yes, go out into the middle of nowhere and just watch the big, wide-open skies.
Very nice. Now, assume you're doing your dream job, but if you weren't, what's your off-the-wall career that you never had?
Oh, so many. There's so many. You know, I would have liked to have been opening the batting for England against India yesterday. That would have been my dream job. Running a retreat in France, that'd be
okay.
A dream job.
Nice.
But I'm really lucky in what I do.
Okay, if you,
yeah, I really am.
Let's assume your dream job was HMCI for Ofsted. How would you approach in school inspections?
Get rid of grading, but I don't think the government would let me. Try and use serving head teachers as much as possible, because they know what the job is like at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that should be the thing, that it should be a peer review system, and maybe every head teacher in the country should take part in inspection. That'd be an interesting approach.
Okay, can I quiz your long-term memory and ask you to repeat the colours of the rainbow in reverse?
So it's Rooibiv, so violet, indigo, blue.
I'm just joking,
yellow,
Paul.
Orange, red.
what is your biggest career achievement to date? What would it be?
Biggest career achievement, working with Ainthorpe Primary Academy in Hull. Brilliant head teacher called Kate Ranner. Lowest results in the city of Hull, and watching her transform that school, and results going from 24% ARE to in the mid-60s, and her getting a good inspection and the fantastic team that she built up.
Great. Top tips for self-publishing a book?
Write, keep writing. Don't stop until you've finished. And talk to people, ask people what they think. You know, you've got trusted friends out there. Give them little bits, show them your plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of things. I mean, you know, joking aside, I think, you know, the plan is so important.
Yeah.
That kind of keeps you on
Great.
Track.
Paul, where, once lockdown ends, where's your first overseas holiday destination?
France.
Okay.
Southwest France. Seeing friends that I've known for the last 10 years, and sitting beside a little river beach.
Fantastic.
With some of those friends. Yeah.
Who would you recommend I interview next, and why?
So just thinking of your week recently.
Yes.
I'm going to name two people. Wayne Norrie.
Right.
CEO of Greenwood. He's a fascinating guy.
Yeah.
Really, you know, I've got a lot of time for him. And my own CEO. He's a really great guy, wants to lead in the right way. So Gavin Booth, I'd put those two up there for you to have a chat
with. All right, great. I'll hunt them down. Where can listeners find out more about you? You know, blogs, tweets, that type of stuff.
So I'm on Twitter at PK Ainsworth. If they search Amazon, No Silver Bullets, Day In, Day Out School Improvement is my new book. And Twitter's the easiest place to then, you know, hunt down my blog and that kind of thing. So at PK Ainsworth.
Okay, and my last question, Paul, you know, your lift pitch, what would be your life legacy? What do you hope to impart to the rest of the world?
So I exchanged a little set of tweets this week with kind of Wayne Norrie, and I was saying the best thing that I could do is give a legacy of more head teachers to know that I've supported some great people so that they can make the difference in their schools. That's what I would like to leave as a legacy, is that some of the people that I've supported along the way, whether they were classroom teachers, heads department or deputy heads, but they will make fab head teachers in their communities and make a difference for those communities that they serve.
Fantastic. So there you go, listeners, Paul Ainsworth. Paul, it's been wonderful to connect with you and have a good chat. Let's not leave it another 10 or 11 years next time, and fingers crossed we can hook up next time you're over in West Yorkshire on your kind of leadership consulting support. So thank you again, Paul.
Thanks, Ross. Really enjoyed talking to you.
And listeners, thank you for tuning in. Any feedback, send it our way. Anyone that you'd like me to interview in the future, just get in touch, teachertoolkit.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.